Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm with Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92 in Seattle. With me are Dale Hien and Christoph Gebel. I will let them, and we were going to be talking about Vietnam generally, particularly reunification since 1975, but also some issues surrounding that date, perhaps before. So, go ahead, introduce yourself. Christoph, you want to go first?
Yeah, hello. My name is Christoph Giebel. I have a joint appointment at UW in the History Department and in International Studies at the Jackson School. I teach about Southeast Asia in general, and my specialization is modern Vietnamese history. And my own involvement in post-war Vietnam, which is the subject of this radio show, is that I became a paramedic on a West German hospital ship in the Vietnamese refugee crisis in 1980-81. So served on that ship in Indonesian waters for about 1 year, and therefore experienced the traumatic situation of refugees that, of course, Yeo Huyen, who is with us today, can speak much more personally about. And I returned as a student to a very decimated post-war Vietnam for 1 year in 1986-87. I was one of the first Western students, in fact, allowed back into Vietnam. And that was a critical year where the victorious Communist Party changed from a Stalinist system to a reform-minded system. And I witnessed that. Myself, I've been back in the early 90s for dissertation research, and then since I've become a professor almost yearly, have been back in Vietnam from the late 90s until today. So it's basically a 46-year journey for me in post-war Vietnam.
And my name is Hoàng Thị Diệu Hiền. I was born and raised in Vietnam in 1961. So I grew up in the war. I was 14 in 1975 when the war ended. I lived in Vietnam until 1979 when I left on a boat. I was one of the boat people and which was what we were known at the time to the world. I ended up in a refugee camp in Indonesia, where Christoph's ship also ended up about six around a few months after I left. I came to the United I resettled in the United States, went to school, and went back to the refugee camp to work as a volunteer in 1985. And then for a summer only, and then returned to the US, completed my education, became a nurse, and got my degrees. I later taught nursing and public health. I think officially I have retired, and that is very new. So in 1989, actually 85, I went back to volunteer in the refugee camp. In 89, 88, my husband and I went to visit Vietnam. First, it was the first time for my husband, who was not Vietnamese, and it was the first time I'd returned for me. And then we returned again in 1989 with the intention of staying and working to alleviate the poverty, to help alleviate the poverty there. We weren't successful in securing the permissions to stay long term, but we were in 1993 when we returned again, and this time we stayed from 93 to 97, working, living, and working in Vietnam as development workers. I was among the first overseas Vietnamese, especially boat people, people who left Vietnam illegally, yeah, meaning we fled Vietnam and returned and lived and worked in Vietnam. Since then, I have worked in global health and have returned to Vietnam many, many times. I still have a lot of relatives, and I go to visit them frequently when I could. The longest period of time that I hadn't returned was during the pandemic, and then during my husband's illness. I first returned after the pandemic last year in the fall with Peacetrees Vietnam, and I also went on one of those trips with Christoph to Vietnam in the spring of this year. So that's my background.
Thank you. I'm going to just interject quickly some personal experience that I had in 2003. I went back. I'm a Vietnam veteran. In 2003, I went back to Vietnam to actually to see if I could find some of the people that I met as an interrogator, linguist, and military intelligence. And through a really remarkable series of events, I ended up meeting and talking to eight NLF soldiers, Viet Dong. Interviewing them and writing a book called Viet Dong National Liberation, Viet Dong and the National Liberation Front, which my two the two guests here were generous contributors to the publication of that book. My initial experience going coming back to Vietnam was that it was a calm, clean, prosperous country. I went to Saigon first. And I think part of that was due to when I was there, South Vietnam was in particular was full of military people like me driving vehicles, trying to curse our way through traffic and being, arrogant and rude but there wasn't any fighting. There were very few police around. It was very calm and collected, although the traffic, of course, is chaotic, but remarkably civil. So anyway, that was my first experience. And subsequently, went back to help publish the book. But anyway, would you guys? I'll let you go ahead first, Christoph. You want to lead off? You're muted. You're muted, Christoph.
I was thinking that since the last radio show that we had was on wartime Vietnam, that I would briefly speak about the immediate aftermath of war. And there are basically three factors that are determining the first decade of the life of and life in post-war Vietnam. And one is the terrible devastations that were left over from the war in 1975, and in many ways a completely destroyed country in its physical appearance, ecological damage, the human potential. So many people had died, families were torn apart. Wherever you look, it's just a completely devastated country. And in many ways, no post-war victorious government of any ideological color would have been able to rebuild without major outside help. So these legacies of war loom very large in 1975. The second is that the outside entanglements almost immediately start bearing down on Vietnam, and that is a very punitive Western embargo. Just when Vietnam needed the most aid to rebuild, It was cut off and embargoed by the West. And then a rather hostile Cambodia and China squeezing it, so to say, from two sides. So the international entanglement was great as well. And we should not forget that Vietnam was not at peace because by 79 it was back at war with Cambodia and China, which lingered well into the 1980s. The third post-war factor was undoubtedly also the complete mismanagement of the victorious Communist Party and its sense of entitlement and its sense of historical triumphalism that not only lashed out against those who were on the losing side of the war, but in something that is very little understood in the West. That also completely cast aside all the allies, revolutionary allies, particularly those in the South, that were absolutely critical to the victory in 1975. So this kind of triumphalism and that led to also the imposition of a very strict Stalinist regime over all of Vietnam that was dominated by a party that was clearly much more northern in character than embracing all the revolutionary shades, particularly those in the South. All these contributed to the post-war malaise, particularly in the first decade between 1975 and 1986. It depends on where your viewpoints are, your political biases. Anti-communists like to emphasize the communist mismanagement and triumphalism. More left-wing supporters of the revolution emphasize the Western embargo and the Chinese and Cambodian hostility. And I usually take a middle road and say, all of these factors have played a role. And we should never forget also the complete devastations and that monumental rebuild task that would have overwhelmed any government of any shade after 1975. So this is basically to set the scene for the very steep decline in the fortunes of Vietnam after 1975. When people were expecting actually peace broke out, everybody was happy, at least that the fighting and the killing was over, and people were expecting improvements in their lives, and in fact, it went downhill for another decade before things changed dramatically. And we can talk about this in a second, but I want to hand it off to Hien, because you lived through these initial 5 years. Or 4 years after the victory of 1975, and I'd like to know a little bit more to put flesh on my bones that I just laid out there.
Sure, Christoph. Thank you for that context. I just a little more background about myself. My parents, my mom is from the South, and actually her home village is from the Tây Ninh province, which borders Cambodia, and that is will become significant here in a minute. And my dad is from the north. He his family is Northern Catholics, and they fled south in 1954 when the country was divided. So almost his entire family, my grandparents' descendants. The entire family went south, but the larger relatives, some of them remain. So in 1975, oh, and back up a little more. So I have families from my dad's side who stayed behind in the north. My mom's side of the family, some of her siblings joined the revolution during the war, during the French time, and they continue on. My aunt was assigned by the revolution to move north. She left behind her 18-month-old son for my grandmother to raise, and I grew up with him, and he lived with us for a time. I have one uncle who was missing during the French time, and one uncle stayed behind, was assigned to stay behind and fight. That uncle was captured in 1962, and he was returned to the North in 1973 at the prisoner exchange. He came back in 1975. He followed the troops south through and went through the Cambodia border, got his sons out of his. He had a wife and four children, three of whom were sons. He of draft age, so he asked his sons to be sent into the jungle along the Cambodian border to so that they will not be put in a position to fight him. My cousin, who was left behind for my grandmother to raise, also went into the jungle during the I think in the early 70s. I have cousins, same family, my mom's siblings who fought for the South, who were soldiers in the South. So immediately after the war ended, it was a sense of euphoria. First of all, it was no more fighting. But then next was, I get to meet all these people I've heard about, never met before. I've read their letters to my grandmother. And my cousins, they had spent time at my house, so I would get to see them again. And it did happen. It was immediately after the end of the war, about 1975, 1976. We celebrated every time a person show up. First it was one uncle and then another, and then my aunt and my cousins from the north came back south. Her husband was actually in the negotiating party for the Paris Accord, and he remained at the airport, at Tan Shan Yat Airport, as an observer, right, of the Paris Accord. And Christoph, if you could talk more about the academic side about that in a little bit. But we didn't know this. He was the first one that showed up. He came, I don't know how he knew where we lived, but he came up at the house, and here was an officer show up in a crisp uniform with a driver, and he knocked on the door, and I was scared. I never met him, and he told me who he was, and then it was a very emotional reunion of someone I've never met before. And he said how I looked like his wife, my aunt, and that he hadn't seen his family for years since he'd been south. So it was very emotional, and that aunt later became my closest aunt of all my aunt and uncles. So shall I stop there for a minute?
Well, you said this was the euphoria, the initial euphoria. Bring us to 1979 and your decision to leave.
Right. I have to start with the school that I went to. The school that I attended was a K-12, a public school when I entered it. But before that, the French had built a school for to educate children of their Vietnamese employees. At the time, the school was called École de Française de Jutland, de Cholon. In 1967, the school was handed over to the management of the Republic of Vietnam's government. And so it became a public school and a Vietnamese school. The language of instruction became Vietnamese, not French like it was before. But French teachers were sent, it was sent from France to educate us from the beginning. That is to say, and there were five schools like that in the entire South Vietnam or Republic of Vietnam, two in Saigon, one in Da Lat, one in Nha Trang, and one in Da Nang. So it was very prestigious. We had to take an exam. And now I realize it's one of those exams that IQ exam you give to illiterate kids. We had taken an exam in order to enter the school. My classmates were mostly from the upper crust of Saigon society, either very high officials or very well. Very affluent people. A lot of them have French citizenship, and a lot many of them spoke French, knew French because their parents spoke French. I did not know any of that. I did not belong to that class. If you can compare to some prestigious school, I would be more like one of those scholarship students, even though we didn't get any scholarship. So in 1975, many of them left, left the country because their parents, their fathers were in were high official, very highly placed officials or military officers in the Republic of Vietnam. Those who remain, their fathers were later sent to what was called re-education camp or prisons for political prisons. So about half of my classmates were gone after 75, and then more left after that. And so life immediately after the euphoria of peace and of reuniting or meeting with my relatives quickly turned into, wow. A sense of uncertainty and a sense of, it's sort of big sense of loss. Many of my friends who remained behind, their homes were confiscated, and they had to, some had to go to re-education camp, no, sorry, to new economic zone, which was newly cleared jungle. Back in those days, we, the kids, were thinking that those were like punishment for the families of the former officials of the Republic of Vietnam. Some of those families went because they were hoping that will buy some favor or points for their family to return from the prison. We didn't learn very much. Many of our teachers also left. As you may note, the teachers were also of prestigious background, a lot of them, not all, and they also left. And so we had new teachers. We had teachers that came from the north. We had teachers that came out of the jungle to teach us. And a lot of my classmates make fun of them. For example, the French teacher didn't pronounce things correctly because we learned it straight from French, stuff like that. There was the war continue in the classroom, in society, in a different way, not with guns and bullets, but with words and with animosity, resentment. So I wasn't learning much, and I'm addicted to learning. I've realized I've gone back to school so many times in my life. And I really felt that I wasn't learning very much except communism and Leninism and Marxism, even in French class or in math. The examples used were just to indoctrinate us and not to provide knowledge or not to educate. And I one day when my mom, but I did not think that I would ever leave because my family, it took a lot of money and you have to have that elite background to be able to have the connection and to have the money to leave. I didn't think we have that. One day my mom came home and said, "Hien, if you have a chance, would you go?" And I said, "Yes." She was shocked. But she had enough money, or she borrowed enough money to pay for my trip out halfway. I had to pay the rest. She asked me that. I said, "I'm happy to do that." My mom was just absolutely shocked because I felt like there were so many things that after the end of the war, after 75, I was told about the war. In particular, the most significant was at the time, it was called the War Crime Museum, the American War Crime Museum. It was named that at the beginning. And I was told things that were sometimes the opposite of what I've heard during the war growing up in the South. And I had no idea what was right and what was wrong. And so I've decided that I had to go outside of Vietnam to find that out if I wanted to. And I have a curious mind. I just want to know the truth. And so that was my door out. And also because I wanted to learn and I wasn't learning in school. The teachers didn't have the heart to teach. The students didn't have the heart to learn. No learning was happening. So I said yes, and I did leave on knowing that there was a lot of risk, but because some of my friends already left before me and I received letters back from them. So I said to mom, "All my friends who have left, I've heard from them. Therefore, the risk is low. I will take that risk. I will go." And that too really baffled my mom. But she made the trip happen. What I did not realize at the time was because we all left surreptitiously, I didn't know the total number of people who left. I only knew of the ones who left and made it. The ones who didn't make it didn't write me back, and I didn't know that they have left. And so I made my calculation based on the wrong equation, but luckily I made it in one trip. Yeah, but that's it. Is that it's not just economic hardship. There was a lot of that, and I'm not that did not deter me. I felt we were a poor country, we've been through war, and I can live this way. It's okay. But it was the control of the mind that I did not like.
You mentioned the camps, the re-education camp. I just want to make a quick remark here. Some of the people I talked to had been imprisoned after the war, or during the war actually, and came out of the prisons, Khon San Island in particular, had to be carried out. And they were tortured and abused. It was horrific. And that didn't really come to, even for the Communist Party, they didn't know exactly all the conditions that were there. And I think that some of the retribution, if you want to call it that, for government officials, Southern government officials, was because of their knowledge of what happened in the camps, which was pretty ugly.
Yeah, maybe we can justify that for the treatment of the former officers and high-level government officials of the Republic of Vietnam. But I have to I want to emphasize what Christoph said. Not only they were being mistreated, the third force, that's the third force, the people who were independent, and they were more pro-revolution, but for the most part. And they were sidelined. They were disillusioned. Actually, the person that I left with, that my mom entrusted to leave on that perilous boat, and I forgot to mention, I left by myself without my family. That person was among the third force, and she got disillusioned, and she became very, very anti-communist after she arrived here in the US. Now, I also have family members who were part of the NLF, and they were sidelined, and they became very bitter afterwards. I talked to them after I returned to Vietnam, after having been in the US and then returned, and I talked to him, and he said, I talked to him about the regime, and he said, "You know, just think of it this way. I have a shirt, and I have only the one shirt. It's really tattered. It's falling off my body, but this is the only shirt I have, so I'm wearing it." And he's referring the shirt to the government, to the regime, as he just kind of have to put up with it. But eventually, he did send his children out of the country, and he too immigrated later. We lost touch, and I'm very sorry that we did, but I would think that they also have a hard time overseas because of his involvement during the war.
Yes, and maybe I can jump in and say that after that year as a student in the 1980s, I came back as a dissertation research student in the early 90s, and I did quite a bit of research in the southern half of the country in the Mekong Delta, and I was able to get in touch with some of the former National Liberation Fronts of AKA Viet Cong cadres and journalists and intellectuals who were aligned with either the neutral third force people or with the NLF, revolutionary allies of the Communist Party, but not necessarily communists. And even in the early 90s, the amount of bitterness and resentment of having been cast aside by a northern-dominated Communist Party that would no longer allow any dissent or pluralism in political representation was just palpable. Some of the contacts that I sought were not available. They were still under house arrest. They were enjoined from talking to foreigners. And the struggle within the party to allow a more southern revolutionary viewpoint to gain some relevance was still going on. It started really in 1986 when the Communist Party changed direction very drastically from a Stalinist system to a market-oriented reform system, which allowed some of these suppressed southern revolutionary voices to be heard again. But it was a struggle. They organized internal party lobbies, the Club of Former Resistance Fighters. as it was called, that was banned in 1990. So in the early 90s, there was still a lot of resentment, and it really only started healing under the leadership of Wu Jigong, who was a very, very trusted Southern revolutionary. Unfortunately, he died too young in office. That was probably when the rift between Southern and Northern revolutionaries was really healing and going forward. I just want to emphasize what Heian said. I mean, this is not just a retribution campaign against actually the communist propaganda towards the end of the war of reconciliation. Everybody's welcome to rebuild Vietnam. Well, the reality was there was, of course, retaliation and collective punishment against those who were supporters of the defeated Republic, Saigon government. But it went much further. And that is something that is, even today in Vietnam, something that people are very uncomfortable talking about. That actually the one segment of the population that was most central to the outcome of 30 April 1975, and that is Southern revolutionaries, that they were cast aside and discriminated against and silenced in that first decade and a half after the war.
Just let me reinforce that sort of thing. The people that I talked to that were NLF soldiers and Viet Dong soldiers, the narratives that they gave me and that they were edited, they originally said some things that were critical of the government. And I took those narratives back for them to look at them, and they said, "Oh, well, maybe I won't. I'll edit that." So privately, they said, "Not in print." They said that they had not been treated. They complained to me that they had not been treated well, and you mentioned that the first one of the first things that the party did after regaining control of the entire country was disband the NLF.
Yes.
They didn't want any kind of competition.
Yes.
So, yes.
Yeah, in the US, I continue to work in the Vietnamese communities with newcomers. One time I met these young people who are of high school age, and they've been in the US for a year, just arrived. And they saw at the Wing-Luc Museum that some photos of shortly after 75, and they saw the flag, the half blue, half pink flag with a yellow star in the middle. That's
Yep.
the National Liberation Front flag. Not that one, not that one. Yeah. So they saw that flag and they pulled me aside and they said, "What is that?" They did not know what that flag was. I was flabbergasted that they didn't know, because, I mean, without them, I don't know though that the communist side could have won the war.
Yes.
Yeah. My uncle, who was in the South captured, continued to fight in prison. And then when he was released, after he was rehabilitated, what did he do? He went south again, and with his son, they fought in the jungle until the end. And so, yeah.
So, Mike, with your permission, if I can jump in about 1986 a little bit, because I was actually in Hanoi as one of the first Western students. It took me 1.5 years from West Germany to get a visa, permission to study at the University of Hanoi. I arrived in September 1986. And within 3.5 months of my arrival, there was the famous Sixth Party Congress of the Communist Party. And that became a historic party congress because in December 1986, some of the old guard, Lê Duẩn in particular, had died. The most orthodox Stalinist leader of the party had just died before. the year before. And they were two separate but connected developments that put a lot of pressure on the Communist Party to change course. One was obvious for many observers around the world, was the reform course of Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. And we have to remember that in the late 70s and early 1980s, Vietnam was completely dependent on the Soviet Union because of the state of war that they were in with China, with Communist China. And now, in that holy grail of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev was starting actually a reform process that bore fruits, right? Bringing in market competition, profit motivation, leading away from the Stalinist command economy, and all of these things, and also a political liberalization, right? So this was Gorbachev, and it put a lot of pressure on the Vietnamese communist leadership. The second one, which is much less understood in the West, is that because of the reform movement in the People's Republic of China under Deng Xiaoping, there were already in the North local efforts to also bring in market competition and to liberalize a little bit that economic system that had brought about stagnation and immiseration on a massive scale throughout Vietnam. And I'm emphasizing that was in the North because the North was safe, right? I mean, the Communist Party was very suspicious of the South, but the North was, of course, the most trusted population. And that population was at the boiling point. They said, where's our peace dividend, right? What did we fight for two generations only to have a most miserable life now? And so there were local cadres that took some of the reform impulses from Communist China and implemented that on the local level to great success. And so with these kind of bottom-up and top-down pressures, the new leadership in 1986 decided to change radically, to change course. They call it doi mới, right? The renovation, which is still kind of the concept for Vietnam 40 years later. So we are almost at the 40-year anniversary of that famous party congress. And slowly but steadily got rid of Stalinist elements in the economy. They liberalized the economy. They brought in some market components that accelerated in following years. What I want to contribute here is a little bit my eyewitness account. You know, when I came to Vietnam in September 1986, and for the next few months, of course, it was still in that kind of Stalinist system. And first of all, I came to a country that I have never seen poverty on that level ever before and after in my life. It was just complete immiseration. By United Nations standards or statistics, Vietnam at that point was in the bottom five poorest countries in the world. Most people were on food rationing cards, had to line up for food handouts. My professors, you know, came into my classroom. I learned Vietnamese there, in literally in rags. I mean, in trousers that had patches on them. They had second and third jobs just to make ends meet. I mean, it was just wherever you looked, it was just really, really terrible circumstances. And again, it's not only the fault of the Communist Party. There was a Western embargo. There was Chinese military pressure and all of this, and the devastations of war, right? So I don't want to make this a singular a reason situation, but it was just a complete immiseration and a grinding poverty that is almost impossible to describe to somebody in 2026. When I look back, so I came 40 years ago. In 1986, the Hanoi that I experienced was probably much closer to the Hanoi of 40 years prior, so 1946. That Hanoi to 1986 had probably not changed very much. When you go now to Hanoi, It's a complete different universe. I mean, I pinch myself. I cannot believe that I'm in the same place, in the same Vietnam that I experienced in very different ways in 1986. But in any case, all this to say, in these last months of 1986, I learned to read newspapers and all this, and it was all extremely stilted language, right? I mean, it was just, there was no criticism. Everything was hunky-dory, right? I mean, the daily party newspaper was never saying anything critical. Everything was great. The reality was so drastically different. Then comes the party congress. New leadership arrives, and they are starting to change the whole system, including political liberalization that lasted for about 4 years, right? Until Tiananmen Square and the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then the one-party state comes back. But political and economic liberalization start basically in early 1987. And I will never forget, I was there from September 86 to July 1987. I will never forget that huge change just in the attitude of the people. In January, I mean, there was an outbreak of hope. The people were just, it was electric that finally, after all these years of suffering, there was actually hope that things would be changing for the better. And you could see this as in so simple things as the party general secretary, the newly elected reform-minded one, having a column in the daily party newspaper in which he spoke about problems, errors and mistakes, and pledged to change them, right? And I will never forget one of my professors bursting in my drab classroom with the paper in hand and said, "Christoph, you have to read this. This is just amazing. What you read here, right? This is for the first time in years they were actually speaking about reality and the truth of the miserable situation and how a path forward could be imagined." So when I left in July 1987, not much had changed in the economic situation. That only really starts up in 88, 89. Then you see really changes in, the near famine levels that were there in 86, 87, probably lasted in well into 87. But in any case, what I want to emphasize is that there was a palpable feeling of hope, and we finally have turned the corner. And if you look back now, of course, 40 years, that is in fact true, right? I mean, this set Vietnam on its more modern path, where Vietnam nowadays, when you visit, I mean, it's a thriving country. Yes, oppressive one-party state, right? Authoritarian, but it's a thriving country. It's young, it's dynamic, it's well integrated globally. It's unimaginable almost, the situation at the beginning of this fateful party congress.
If I may add to that, I'd like to reinforce what Christoph said about when you first arrived in 1986, Christoph, how everything was hunky-dory. Everything that was happening in country was beautiful. The government was doing everything right. Well, that's what drove me away, because I knew that that wasn't the truth, and I just wanted truth, and I felt like I couldn't live in a country that tried to blind my eyes and control my mind. And so I left. And when I went to Hanoi for the first time in 1989, that devastation, that poverty was still so evident. I remember arriving at the airport, Nội Bài Airport, and this is the main airport in the capital of the country. It was a one room with no air conditioning and one fan blasting hot air around. It was so hot and so hard. I cried. I cried at the airport. I cried on the way from the airport into town because of the poverty, the level of poverty that I was seeing compared to where I came from, where I was born in Saigon. It wasn't like that. It was so sad. I just couldn't control myself. But I also, because we're out of time, I also want to put in this, that yes, the government changed. There's been a lot of reform. There's been better management here and there in places and change in policy. But I would want to say that the liveliness that we see now, or the lack of poverty that we see now, or the economic condition that we see now, there is a lot of contribution from overseas Vietnamese that went into that. It's not just from the inside. The overseas Vietnamese do a lot of harm too, I feel, to the culture itself and to social norms. But I think economically, that contribution cannot be understated.
Thank you, Hien and Christopher. I'm going to have to finish this off now. So this is Mike Diedrich at broadcast on KODX 96.9. This program will be aired there probably Wednesday, if not later. But thanks a lot to Hien and Christoph for doing this very important historical, political, and personal recollections. I think that people will enjoy listening to this broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thank you, Mike and Krista.